This is an ABC podcast.
Hi, this is David Rutledge on RN. Welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. If you're an academic working in the humanities and social sciences these days, you might be feeling a little on the defensive. University funding for the humanities is shrinking, and its various disciplines seem to be constantly taking fire from all sides in those never-ending culture wars. There's also a perception abroad these days that human progress is really about technology and economics, and that feels like literature or languages or religious studies, or dare I say philosophy, are a bit of a luxury, certainly a less serious pursuit than the STEM fields. That's science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And this perception gives rise to one rather challenging question: who needs the humanities? Well, that very question was the topic of a forum recently held at Deakin University in Melbourne. The forum brought together a range of speakers who were all examining the value of humanities research. And in today's program, we're going to be hearing from three of them. First up is Joy DeMoussy, Professor of History at the University of Melbourne and current President of the Australian Academy of the Humanities, with something of a corrective to anyone who might think that the humanities and the STEM fields inhabit separate universes.
In answer to the question posed in this forum, who needs the humanities, I would suggest we all do, and desperately and urgently so. In looking at the value of humanities research, I wanted today to consider two aspects relating to this, to the vital importance of humanities to the future workforce. That's my angle today. So the first aspect is the value I want to look at of research skills that humanities offer in the wider world of work. And second of all, the insights humanities research can bring as we embark on the changing technological landscape of artificial intelligence and the fourth industrial revolution. So first of all, to my first point, the humanities research skill set that relates to the workforce. There have been many reports in Australia and overseas which have highlighted skills gained through studying arts and humanities, and these have led to high-level debates about the value of these skills to the individual, to society, and of course, as we've heard as well, to the economy. So I'm involved in one such report called The Future Humanities Workforce, which has been led by the Australian Academy of the Humanities and is funded by the Australian Research Council to look at the contribution, amongst other things, of the humanities workforce in Australia. So what our and other reports overseas have indicated is that the demand is growing for individuals to be equipped with higher level skills, which they can deploy in different contexts, whether in a career which may across many sectors of employment or within a research community, which is increasingly becoming interdisciplinary. Improving the skills base is crucial to increasing productivity and meeting the challenges of a constantly changing workforce. So when we're looking at the value of humanities research, one way to look at it is in terms of the research skill set and its value. So what is this skill set? So this core of skills, I think, is shared by undergraduates and postgraduate students, early career researchers, and the level of proficiency changes as individuals become more advanced in their study. Research skills in the humanities are framed around six core elements and values. First, communication, a clear, coherent explanation and description, that skill set, presenting that. Pervasive arguments underpinned by evidence, using diplomacy and negotiation, respecting others' views. Second of all, conducting research itself and collecting evidence, formatting a research question and determining the evidence needed to answer the question, locating and retrieving textual, numerical and visual information from existing sources. Third and crucially, analysing, come back to this, analysis, assessing what the evidence might mean, recognising where it is incomplete, ambiguous and unreliable. Evaluating findings to come to a conclusion, taking into account different perspectives and evaluating the complexity of the material. Critical thinking, of course, is at the heart, and reflection on taken-for-granted answers and assumptions to problems and value assumptions. Fourth, decision-making, establishing criteria and evaluating evidence against it. Fifth, problem-solving, applying knowledge to find solutions in a creative and innovative way. And finally, adaptability and creativity, a willingness to try different approaches, being open and receptive to new ideas. So humanities graduates and researchers participate in and contribute to civil society, drawing on their understanding of the human dimension of the society. Engagement with the arts and culture helps individuals to understand themselves and their lives and appreciate the diversity of human experiences and cultures. And for these reasons, the humanities are valued in a wide range of professions, not necessarily dependent on the specific knowledge of the subject they have studied. Their strong generic skills and flexibility mean that they're able to adjust to the requirements of work in many different areas. And others, of course, go on to specialist employment routes, which are vital to society, or go on to become the next generation of researchers, enabling the disciplines to continue to contribute to the cultural, social and economic health, wealth and reputation of Australia. It is vital that this distinctive contribution continues to be recognised and valued. Many employees, such as the banks, corporations and a range of industries, have publicly recognised the high value and centrality of these skills in the future workforce. One crucial aspect which humanities researchers bring is an understanding of the human consequences of developments. And I think this is really important in understanding the distinctive contribution. Looking at human consequences of various developments, such as artificial intelligence, which can be used to shape the legal, moral and ethical frameworks which need to be created as part of the new digital age. And this takes me to my second point, the contribution and analysis of humanities research to the changing workforce, such as AI, and the human impact of these developments. So this week, some of you may be aware that a very timely report was released by the four academies called The Effective and Ethical Development of Artificial Intelligence, an Opportunity to Improve Our Wellbeing. A humanities-based analysis is at the very heart of this investigation into AI. And what does this mean precisely? Here, I think we can see the true value of a humanities examination. So in the report, which I recommend highly to you, it looks not only at the scientific and technological aspects of AI, but explores questions such as human rights, equity and access to technology, inclusion, and questions such as the right to work, a fundamental human right. So for example, many claim that AI will transform the tasks involved in work, create new roles and establish new skill sets, but the consequences of widespread automation are likely to be different for men and for women, with implications for socioeconomic equality and the global gender gap. We can look at other issues such as the right to privacy and the issue of surveillance. Human rights, it is argued in the report, provides a framework by which to approach the safe, fair and ethical implementation of AI technologies. Biases in algorithmic decision-making tools carries the risk of amplifying discrimination, and problems of fairness arise herein. There is a widespread belief that algorithmic decision-making tools are more objective because they are less biased than human decision-makers. Such assertions imply that legal protection against unfair discrimination might not be relevant to objective algorithmic decision-making. Human prejudice and algorithmic bias differ in character, but both are capable of generating grossly unfair and discriminatory decisions. Tackling this problem will be particularly challenging owing to the contested nature of fairness and discrimination in technology, but humanities analysis leads the way. And finally, it's argued that AI will depend on the confidence that society places in the technology. The issue of trust in AI systems raises a number of definitional problems, including trust that the algorithms will produce the desired output, trust in the values underpinning the system, trust in the way data in the system are protected and secured, and trust that the system has been developed for the good of all stakeholders. Such questions of trust take users far beyond the simpler matter of whether they believe in the technology, that the technology works. It also opens up the matter of ethics, and so on and so forth. My point here is that all the core skills that I outlined earlier are fundamental to a humanities researcher. We can see applied in ample measure here to the critique, analysis and the understanding of, for example, AI, and in so doing, promoting a future based on a cohesive and ethical culture and society in the midst of radical and transformative technological change.
Joy DeMoussy, historian at the University of Melbourne and president of the Australian Academy of the Humanities. She was speaking at the recent forum, Who Needs the Humanities, held at Deakin University. And on RN, you're listening to The Philosopher's Zone. Coming up next, Robert Stern, Professor of Philosophy at the University of Sheffield. And you may remember him from a Philosopher's Zone episode last year. We're going to put a link to that on the website. Robert Stern is a keen promoter of the humanities, but he's also wary of what he sees as three traps that people can fall into when they try to defend the humanities.
The three traps I have in mind are, first of all, the instrumental versus intrinsic value trap, then the part versus the whole trap, and then the progress trap. So starting with the instrumental versus intrinsic value trap. Debates in this area often leave the humanities struggling because they work with an assumption that there is a clear distinction between intrinsic and instrumental value. The sciences then offer themselves as of clear instrumental value in enabling us, for example, to live longer or with more material goods or with greater control of the environment and so on. The humanities then cannot compete directly with these claims to instrumental value, as they cannot obviously do any of these things. We do then get drawn into saying that the humanities have economic benefits or give people transferable skills, for example. But while true, often this seems a bit lame and not to capture what we really care about in our disciplines. The humanities, in response to this problem, instead then claim to have intrinsic value. But this then makes the humanities seem to be a kind of optional indulgence cut off from the kinds of things we need as human beings, like health, material goods, or environmental security. And so, in a rather familiar way, the humanities seem to miss out in these debates and easily get sidelined. But suppose we argued instead, the central aim of the humanities is to help us understand the nature of the good human life. Not just good in the moral sense, but good in the general sense of a flourishing, successful human life, what the Greeks called eudaimonia. This makes the humanities instrumental in part, because by understanding what this good life is, we can then find out how to live it. But it also makes the humanities non-instrumentally valuable because they do not take for granted the end for which they are the means, as the sciences do, but question the nature of that end itself. And the sciences cannot replace the humanities in this area, as the question of the good human life is a normative, value-laden issue, while the sciences are not engaged in the question of value. Once we've decided what the good life is, we can use science to help us get it. But we need humanities to help us decide what it is. Seen in this light, the humanities seem more fundamental than science, but in a way that connects the human good in a different way, as telling us what that good is rather than giving us a means to realize it. To take a simple example, what is the place of death in a good human life? How should the life of a human being end in a way that adds to the value of that life or does not detract from it? How much control should a human being have over the end of their life? It is hard to see how science could answer any of these questions, but many disciplines in the humanities offer answers, or at least ways of thinking about them, from history to theology to philosophy to literary studies to anthropology and cultural studies. And it seems only when we have thought about the issues this way that science has anything to offer in delivering what we think is required in achieving the end that has been established by the humanities. So my first suggestion is that when we come to defend the humanities, we do not get drawn into assuming the instrumental intrinsic value contrast is a simple one. Turning now to a second trap, which is trying to defend the whole by the parts. What I mean by this is that I think few people would reject the value of whole areas of the humanities, such as English, history, philosophy, and so on. I don't think anyone is seriously proposing closing those things down. I think no one seriously would say we should not have these disciplines and that they lack value. But often the disciplines are not what are criticised, but individual research projects, such as taxation in Elizabethan England or the early works of Hegel. Taken on their own, it can seem problematic to justify these projects, which can seem recherché and a luxury. And this is then used as a way to cast doubt on the whole discipline. But this is a mistake, as within any complex system of inquiry, individual parts, when taken in isolation, can seem to lack value or significance. And the same will be true in science as well. For example, if one is investigating the flight path of the seagull or the physics of push-ups. I should say I got that one off the internet, so it may be fake news. But of course, these individual inquiries get their significance from being part of a wider whole. And it is that whole which we should be defending in its own terms, not individual projects taken in isolation. And finally, a third trap, I think, is the question of progress. We are all familiar with the complaint that the humanities lack value because they do not make progress in the manner of the sciences. Why do we continue to fund and sponsor them if they are not getting anywhere? My own response to this is to introduce a hermeneutical idea here, the idea of interpretation. Take a text like Hamlet. This text obviously requires interpretation, and there are better and worse ways in which this can be done. But I don't think anyone would say that there will ever be a final interpretation of Hamlet, one account which surpasses all others, which represents the end of the interpretative line. This is because, of course, Hamlet is a complex text, open to many different readings. But on the other hand, this process of interpretation is not entirely open and unbounded. There are better and worse interpretations, and there is a discipline in inquiring into the text. No one, I think, would claim that because there is no final interpretation of Hamlet, we should view all such interpretations as worthless. By contrast, it does make sense to think that there might be a final science, which fully captures how the world works, into which all other accounts can be fitted. But this seems the wrong model for literary interpretation, but not in a way that devalues it. Now, it seems to me we can view the humanities in an analogous way. The humanities are investigating what might be called the human condition, and offering different accounts and interpretations of it. It seems implausible to think that these interpretations could ever be fully finished or fitted together into one single story. But on the other hand, as in the Hamlet case, this does not seem to be a flaw in the method or approach, but just what makes the humanities distinctive as a form of inquiry. So if this is right, we should avoid getting drawn into the progress trap too. I've therefore suggested that in the context of these debates, there are three traps which we should avoid, but which we are often pushed into by the terms of these debates. If we can challenge the assumptions underlying these traps, then that might perhaps be one way in which we can make headway in these discussions.
Robert Stern, Professor of Philosophy at Sheffield University in the UK. And you're in the Philosopher's Zone with three speakers this week from the recent conference at Deakin University in Melbourne titled, Who Needs the Humanities? Well, finally, we're going to hear from Miriam Bankowski. She's Senior Lecturer in Politics at Melbourne's La Trobe University.
I'll speak to three points today. The first is that amid the diverse accounts of the value of the humanities research explored in this forum, everyone seems to agree on one central point. The value of humanities research is not reducible to the willingness of others to pay for it. Be that as it may, my second point is that the institutional battleground for determining the value of humanities research is increasingly formulated in precisely these terms. Show us the money, and then we'll know that your research has value. This forum has presented the value of humanities research in plural ways, but none are reducible to the monetary value. And even when Joy DeMussy says that the very skills of humanities researchers have workforce value, she would no doubt acknowledge that many employers don't recognise the value of these skills, which is why her work is so important, and that these skills actually have value in excess of what employers themselves might just so happen to pay. The virtue ethicist Martha Nussbaum, in her book Not For Profit, provides additional reasons to dismantle any link between value and willingness to pay. Her views would have resonated strongly with Robert Stearns today, who looks at the value of the humanities research as helping us to see what a good life consists in. She locates the value of humanities research in the pro-social effects that they have on the flourishing of individuals and in their positive flow-on effects in creating citizens who can sympathetically imagine their way into the predicaments of others. The irreducibility of the social, workforce and cultural value of the humanities to the willingness of others to pay reflects that it's a kind of public good in the economic sense, which leaves it particularly vulnerable to being under-resourced. For economists, a public good doesn't just mean that something is good for society. It rather means that something is non-excludable. A lighthouse, for example. A lighthouse cannot exclude boats from benefiting from its light source, even if the captains of the boats are not paying for the benefit. And a public good is also non-rivalrous, as economists put it. A lighthouse can permit many boats to benefit from its light source at the same time. Humanities research and culture, published and publicised in the public forum, are also non-excludable and non-rivalrous. We can't exclude those who are unwilling to pay from benefiting from its values. And there are benefits that can be enjoyed by many members of society at the same time. A cultural issue. Although mainstream economists agree that the public sector should fund advances in general knowledge, just as it funds lighthouses, they also agree that it's highly likely that the public sector will fail to pay the right amount for the right kind of things. Public goods are vulnerable goods. So the second point is that even though the value of humanities research is not equivalent to the willingness of others to pay, we're constantly asked, aren't we, to justify what we do in precisely these terms. Show us the money. Incentives from government to increase external funding have basically coerced universities into demanding that humanities researchers fund their public good by themselves through mechanisms like the research block grants calculation methodology. The government now allocates its own research funding to universities based on how much of a proportion of external funding a university has been able to attract in relation to its peers. The idea is that the government would only give your institution money to fund your research internally if you manage to secure external funding, either from government grant organisations like the Australian Research Council or from public sector tenders, and increasingly so, industry grants and philanthropic bequests. This basically constitutes a covert attack on academic freedom. This is my third point. Academic freedom is often defined as an institutional right afforded to you in your professional role. It's not freedom of speech or freedom of expression, with which it's commonly confused in the public realm. It includes the right to choose what to research and how to research it, as well as the right to produce your research as a public good, publishing and publicising it. So how is the academic freedom of humanities researchers undermined by funding agreements that identify its value with willingness to pay? Well, first, academic freedom is merely formal and not real if researchers lack resources. Virginia Woolf made a similar point with respect to the conditions of creativity. If women didn't write to the same degree as men, it was because they lacked, as she put it, money and a room of their own. A condition that now defines the experience of most humanities researchers. Last year, we saw the previous Minister for Education veto $4.2 million of ARC grants in the humanities, as we've previously discussed. The vetoed projects included research into cultural change, into the role of sport in responding to climate change, research into art and history, and its history at the interface of Christian and Muslim cultures at the Africa-Europe border, and studies of what strategies a traditionally industrial suburb uses to deal with industrial closure. And because we are less able to secure this sort of funding, which is then rewarded a second time by the research block grants calculation methodology, universities are now unwilling to resource our projects with internal funds either. And so instead, our teaching loads increase, our administrative burdens soar, we see the cross-subsidisation of sciences using the money from teaching our humanities students. We are left with no money, no time, and no room of our own to ask and answer the questions that we think need to be answered for the public good. Not what stakeholders think with their narrow interests, but what we think. The very topics that humanities researchers are choosing to pursue is also changing. We are now forced to propose projects that direct our research towards those more narrow interests, public sector needs, industry interests, and yes, they're important, but we shouldn't forget the drive that Robert Stern and Martha Nussbaum have also been speaking about that lies at the heart of our role. Our work is increasingly bound by funding agreements to pose only certain types of questions, and sometimes we even face coercive pressures to discover only certain types of answers. So there are risks that ensue when the value of humanities research is reduced to willingness to pay. So the need to clarify the value of the humanities really cuts to the very heart of the role and function that universities should play. Who needs the humanities? Everyone who values the public good of research and academic freedom.
Miriam Bankowski, Senior Lecturer in Politics at La Trobe University. And I should just mention that Miriam Bankowski would like it to be known that her contribution here expresses her own professional viewpoint and not the viewpoint of the university that employs her. And of course, no one will miss the irony that such a disclaimer needs to be attached to that presentation. We also heard Robert Stern from Sheffield University and Joy DeMussy from the University of Melbourne. They were all speaking at the recent conference hosted by Deakin University, Who Needs the Humanities? More information on the website. This has been The Philosopher's Zone, and you can find us at abc.net.au/rn or via the ABC Listen app. Next week, we're looking at aged care and the ethics of lying to dementia patients. Those little white lies can make dementia care a lot less stressful for everyone, but do they amount to an erosion of human dignity? I'm David Rutledge, and I hope you can join me then. Bye for now.